From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, civil society in China after the quake. Basra starts to relax just a little bit, and 2020 cricket in India. In the aftermath of China's devastating earthquake, it's been striking to see how many of the Chinese government's usually strict rules have now been loosened. Media coverage has been extensive, and volunteers and NGOs have also been allowed a much wider role than usual. Huge numbers of people from churches and environmental groups have flocked to Sichuan province to help out. And as NPR's Rob Gifford reports, that might have long-term consequences for the Chinese government.
The Christians of Chengdu are mobilizing. At a warehouse on the outskirts of the city, a group of 12 Chinese believers from a local church are stacking boxes of instant noodles, medicine and blankets and loading them up in their cars for the two-hour drive north to the earthquake zone. Staying in touch through walkie-talkies, the convoy heads north. Stuck to the outside of each car is a large red sticker with bright yellow Chinese characters proclaiming who they are. Christians helping the disaster zone. Just to be safe, however, the leader of the group says simply to call him Brother John. We've organized all of this ourselves, he says. People are very pleased with what the government has done, but there is so much need. As to whether it's legal, he adds, I don't think the government really has time to think about that at the moment. The Chinese government is traditionally very wary of non-governmental organizations or public activism of any sort, what's sometimes known as civil society. Beijing likes to keep everything under its own control. But the combination of newfound wealth, newly built infrastructure, newfound patriotism, and in this case, newfound faith, has brought volunteers from all over China to help for free. 2 hours later, members of the group are singing hymns with a small congregation whose own church building was badly damaged in the earthquake. The service takes place among the emergency tents in the open air.
Amen.
Brother John sweats in the heat as he preaches on Paul's letter to the Philippians, and he ends the service with a long series of prayers.
Amen.
After the service, the visitors unload some of the food and clothes they've brought. Then they climb into their cars and head out to the countryside, where earthquake damage has been even worse. Outside the empty shell of what was once their farmhouse, peasants line up for bags of food and clothing. A smiling farmer called Mrs. Chen thanks the group for their donations, echoing the gratitude of everyone in her village and all the villages that Brother John and his friends visit this afternoon. You can see the sheer thrill that John and his colleagues get from what they're doing. Certainly, the earthquake has brought us a lot of new space to organize, he says, though he adds that he has no idea if this sort of activity will still be allowed once the emergency has eased. As he and his friends pile back into their cars and head for the city, they and the other thousands of volunteers may now present a very real long-term problem for Beijing. It's all very well when the organizing is fully supportive of the government, but what if, at some future date, it were not? And once people have tasted such empowerment, such freedom to organize, such participation, can you ever really take that away from them? Rob Gifford, NPR News, Chengdu, China.
The US military says violence in Iraq is continuing to decrease. Part of the reason is the success of recent Iraqi army operations in Baghdad and in the southern city of Basra. Before the offensive there, competing Shiite militias were in control of Iraq's second largest city. Assassinations, kidnappings, and intimidation were rife. Now there are 40,000 Iraqi soldiers and police in Basra, and the atmosphere has changed. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports.
Neda Alwan hesitantly peeks around the door. Though she's only 50, the wrinkles on her face are deeply etched. A widow with five children, Neda suddenly smiles when she sees who's come to visit. The visitor, Nidal Hussein, is well known here. She's lived in this neighborhood all her life. In 2004, Nidal's husband was killed in a rocket attack. Her three children were hideously burned. One lost his leg. Instead of being consumed with grief, she decided to help others like herself. In 2005, Nidal joined six friends from her neighborhood, Karada, to aid the less fortunate.
Nobody helped me, so I decided to help others to make a small change in these bad circumstances that we live in. My dream was to place a smile on the face of a widow or an orphan.
Nidal and her friends help about 400 families in the neighborhood, among them Neda, the woman she's visiting, and her five children. Neda says she couldn't get by without their help.
I depend on these people. Through their help, I can now raise my children. I don't have a salary or any other source of support.
There is a saying in Iraq, Al-Jar Lil-Jar, meaning neighbors help neighbors. The last bloody 5 years has deeply fractured the Iraqi sense of community. Neighbors have instead killed neighbors. Families have been displaced into areas where they know no one. But Neda says that despite everything that's happened, grassroots organizations like this one have kept that communal spirit alive.
This has helped me survive all these years. I don't want to move to another neighborhood because in the new area nobody will know me or my circumstances. Here, everybody knows me, so they help.
The charity is run out of a nearby shop where one of the members works. The founding members all have regular jobs. Nidal works at a university. One is a welder. Another is a blacksmith. Karim Yasser sells cell phones. He says he decided to start the organization in early January 2005, after a day the Iraqis called Bloody Thursday, when a spate of suicide bombings in the Karada area left many dead and injured.
We consider all the Iraqis who were killed as brothers, fathers, sons, sisters. We feel responsible for each one of them and their families.
No one was helping, he says. The Iraqi government, the Americans, and the most vulnerable, widows and orphans, were particularly at risk. He called the newly formed group the People of Goodness and Mercy, and with others who felt the same way, they began to do what they could. Nidal says because she was also a widow, she understood how badly a woman alone can fare. Often their families abandon them. Many become prostitutes.
A widow faces all kinds of difficulties. When her son tells her that he is hungry, she can't feed him. When he wants new clothes, she can't buy them. And then she meets bad people who try to use her because she has nobody to protect her.
Money is raised through donations from the public, but resources are always tight. One of the widows the group supports is a Kurd, Sahira Abed Abbas. Her husband was killed in an attack. She was desperate until they came to help.
They knew about our need, knew that my husband was a martyr, so they knocked on our door.
The charity's deputy director, Ali Hamid, says they are a part of the community of Karada, doing what little they can to help.
We don't believe in the organizations that own palaces or whatever. We operate in the street where the violence takes place.
His fellow charity worker, Nidal Hussein, nods. She says, we all live in this neighborhood. We have this bond. We know each other, so we have to help each other too. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
Coming up, cricket fast and furious in India.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. If you build it, they will come. That line from a baseball movie turns out to be also true of cricket. India's launched a new league for playing a shortened, pepped-up form of that traditionally sedate English game, and it's making bucket loads of money. It's become both a national obsession in India and evidence of the changes underway there. NPR's Philip Reeves reports.
It's a sultry evening in India's commercial capital, Mumbai. In a sports bar on the seafront, Abhishek James arrived for his daily fix, a beer and a game.
Honestly speaking, 3.5 weeks, every match I have watched. Every match. 8 p.m., I'm here to watch the match.
James single, in his early 30s, and in the diamond business.
When I come from my work, I'm tired. Fine, have one beer, 3 hours of match, excitement done, body is rested, that's it, go home and sleep, that's it.
James scrutinizes one of the bar's giant screens. The game's warming up nicely. Players in brightly coloured uniforms are diving about. This is yet to produce the fix Jane came for, but he's hopeful tonight's game will deliver. This new form of cricket generally does.
It's trendy, it's hip, it's fast, it's furious, and it produces a result. It's what they call the fatafat version of cricket.
That's Ayaz Memon, a Mumbai newspaper editor.
The fatafat, instant. Here and now, instant gratification.
Officially, the game's called 2020 cricket. It's very different from those five-day games played at glacial speed by white-clad men who take breaks for tea and sandwiches. 2020 games last a maximum of 3.5 hours. There's always a winner. The Indian Premier League, or IPL, was put together remarkably quickly. Earlier this year, the governing body of Indian cricket auctioned 8 franchises. The who's who of India pounced. The Bollywood superstar Shah Rukh Khan and vastly wealthy industrialists Mukesh Ambani and Vijay Mallya were among those who bought teams. Cricketing superstars were recruited from India and around the world, including Pakistan. In a matter of weeks, a massively lucrative business had been created, serving as testimony, says Memon, to the way India's changing.
In many ways, the IPL is a statement to, as I see it, to the rest of the world, that India has arrived.
Sujata Mehta's battling through the crowds on her way to watch a game with her 18-year-old daughter. The Indian Premier League's tapped into a new demographic, young people and women. Mehta says she wasn't interested in cricket before. She is now.
It is the excitement, let me be frank, and that's it.
You've got a husband?
Oh, yes.
He's here, right?
No, he's not here. I don't like to watch match with husband.
Why not?
No, he likes to be at home with his beer.
Groups of beggars and itinerants gather by the stadium, as if drawn to the light, like moths. They can't afford tickets to the game, but they found a way of making money out of it. Tiny, grubby, barefooted children sell bottles of water. This is a scam. You're not allowed to take bottled water into the ground. The cops confiscate the bottles and give them to the kids, who sell them back to the arriving crowds. Then the police confiscate the bottles again. Inside, the stadium's crammed full. The high and mighty from Bollywood, industry and politics, some of whom flew in by private jet, are in the hospitality boxes. But on the terraces, the crowd's feverishly excited. A Bollywood number strikes up. The crowd starts dancing. A gyrating clump of eager-eyed men pushes up against the perimeter fence. A few feet away, on the other side, 4 women cheerleaders are prancing about, waving pom-poms and tossing their hair. To spice things up, cheerleaders were brought in from Europe and the US, including a troop from the Washington Redskins. At first, they were scantily clad. There was an outcry from India's conservatives, and after that, the girls put on a few more clothes. These women aren't particularly raunchily dressed. They look like track athletes warming up. All the same, their fans seem enthralled.
Hi, I'm Shishir Joshi. I'm from Mumbai. I love cricket. I love Bollywood.
Shishir Joshi, editorial director of a multimedia company, wasn't expecting the India Premier League's first tournament to be so wildly successful. But his media outlets ended up giving it the same sort of treatment they're planning for the Olympic Games.
All our mathematics have had to be reworked. Nobody anticipated how big it would be.
The cricket overshadowed major world events, such as the Chinese earthquake and Myanmar cyclone. TV ratings for the nightly games went through the roof, outperforming soap operas and reality shows. Back in the sports bar on the seafront, the game's reaching its climax. This is the final. Rajasthan Royals are playing the Chennai Super Kings. That's the diamond dealer Abhishek Jain's unusual way of indicating he's enjoying himself. The scores are agonizingly close. A batsman slogs the ball into the crowd. The game's finally given Jane his fix.
Woo! Hey, Jane! That's it!
Philip Reeves, NPR News, Mumbai.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.